VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, climate change is threatening the sea ice environment of emperor penguins. A new study suggests that 98% of emperor penguin groups may be pushed close to extinction by the year 2100. And about 70% of their groups will be in danger by 2050. The research was published in the journal Global Change Biology. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service recently announced a plan to list the emperor penguins as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Stephanie Genovier is a penguin ecologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She said that emperor penguins need secure sea ice to reproduce, to feed, and to molt. Molting is the replacement of their old feathers with new ones. The new study looked at overall warming developments and the increasing likelihood of extreme weather changes because of global warming. The study noted that extremely low levels of sea ice in 2016 led to a large reproduction failure of an emperor penguin group in Antarctica's Halley Bay. That year, seasonal sea ice broke up before young penguins had time to develop waterproof adult feathers. About 10,000 baby birds drowned, Genovier said. The group did not recover afterward. Emperor penguins reproduce only in Antarctica during winter. Temperatures can reach minus 40 degrees Celsius and wind speeds can reach 144 kilometers per hour. The penguins survive by gathering in groups of several thousand birds. But they cannot survive without enough sea ice. Sarah Ullman is International Program Director at the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity. She said, "These penguins are hard hit by the climate crisis, and the U.S. government is finally recognizing that threat." The U.S. government has listed other species outside the country as threatened, including the polar bear. Polar bears live in Arctic areas and are also threatened by climate change and sea ice loss. Emperor penguins are the world's largest penguins. There are currently between 625,000 and 650,000 of them worldwide. Placing emperor penguins on the threatened list provides protections, such as a ban against importing them for business purposes. Possible effects on the penguins must also be studied by U.S. sea fisheries currently operating in Antarctica. Martha Williams is Principal Deputy Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She said, "Climate change affects many animal species around the world." She added, "The decisions made by policymakers today and during the next few decades will determine the fate of the emperor penguin."
U.S. land managers have begun efforts to capture about 50% more wild horses than originally planned this year because of severe drought across the U.S. West. That means they will capture about 6,000 additional animals, mostly in the western states of Nevada, Oregon, and Colorado. The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, said the emergency roundups, or mass capture, began Sunday in Oregon and Monday in Nevada. The BLM actions are centered on places where long-term overpopulation of the herds already has stretched the available food and water to its limits. Nada Wolf Culver is the Bureau's Deputy Director for Policy and Programs. She said, as one of the agencies charged with the responsibility to protect and manage America's wild horses and burros, the BLM is prepared to take emergency action where we can in order to save the lives of these cherished animals. In announcing the effort, Culver said, the agency goal is continuing our efforts to reduce overpopulation across the West. That means having healthy herd sizes that can live through severe conditions like long periods of drought. She noted that droughts are becoming more frequent due to climate change. Those who advocate for the wild horses say that the BLM action comes from pressure from cattle ranchers who want to keep the food and water for their livestock. Horses compete with cattle for the same plants and watering places. Laura Lee is president of the nonprofit group Wild Horse Education. She said she is unhappy that the Biden administration is continuing the policies of former President Donald Trump and previous administrations. They removed the protected horses, but did not limit the number of cattle and sheep grazing on the same land. Lee does not believe the administration's claim to care about the environment and wild animals. While ranchers are harming the land, we blame the horse, she said. Caitlin Glover is executive director of resources for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. She said ranchers have already made voluntary changes to reduce their use of federal lands for feeding their cattle. She noted that the current drought is more severe than in recent years. Culver said in an email to the Associated Press that the removal of the horses is important to the health of both the horses and the land. Even in times where resources are plentiful, these overpopulated herds cause serious damage to the landscape, she wrote. I'm Jill Robbins.
A new study suggests that rough areas on the moon's surface block sunlight and permit water ice to form across wide areas. The U.S. space agency NASA already confirmed last year that results from two studies suggested water ice likely existed across much of the moon's surface, even during daytime. One of those studies centered on so-called cold traps observed on the moon that hold frozen water. These areas exist in a state of permanent darkness because temperatures are below about minus 160 degrees Celsius. Until now, scientists have not been sure what was permitting these traps to exist, especially since the moon does not have a thick atmosphere to help water survive. One theory was that water molecules could be trapped on the lunar surface inside rock or other material that resulted from meteorite strikes. But a new study by NASA researchers provides another possible explanation for how water ice could remain in many areas of the moon's surface. It presents evidence that the rough, rocky surface creates shadows that permit water ice to survive. The researchers note that past observations suggested there were movements of water through the lunar day. A lunar day is the time it takes for one point on the Earth to make one complete rotation and end up at the same point in relation to the moon. Studies have provided evidence that the amount of water decreased on the moon's surface when sunlight was brightest and increased with less sunlight. The latest study was led by Bjørn Davidson, a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. He teamed up with another JPL researcher, Sona Hosseini, to carry out the research. The team revised past computer modeling to include rough surface areas of the moon that can be seen in images collected from NASA's Apollo missions from 1969 to 1972. The research results recently appeared in the publication Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. The study suggests that as surface frost that forms in cold areas receives sunlight, it can then be cycled into the moon's exosphere. The exosphere is the thin outer area that forms around a planet or satellite object, such as the moon. Frost is far more mobile than trapped water, Davidson said in a statement. Therefore, this model provides a new mechanism that explains how water moves between the lunar surface and the thin lunar atmosphere. The researchers say their study is the first to examine how shadows on the lunar surface can affect the ability of water molecules to survive as frost during the daytime. They noted that such research is important to help scientists better understand how water enters and leaves the moon's exosphere. Hosseini said understanding water as a resource is essential for future NASA missions or any possible private space exploration. She added, if water ice is available in sunlit areas of the moon, future explorers could use it for fuel and drinking water. But first, we need to figure out how the exosphere and surface interact and what role that plays in the cycle, Hosseini said. The researchers say they plan to test their theory by leading a team to develop small sensors to measure signals given off by a molecule contained in water ice. The sensing device will be designed to be used on small landers or robotic explorers that could be sent to the moon in future missions. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we talked about the debate at the convention over the Virginia Plan. The plan was prepared by James Madison and other delegates from the state of Virginia. It described a national government with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. Some delegates feared that such a central government would take away power from the states. But in the end, they approved the proposal. On June 1st, they began debate on the issue of a national executive. It seemed every delegate at the Philadelphia Convention had something to say about the issue. They had been thinking about it for some time. Almost every delegate was afraid to give the position extended powers. Almost no one wanted America's chief executive to become as powerful as a king. Still, many of the delegates had faith in the idea of a one-person executive. Others demanded an executive of three people. James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued for a single executive. He said the position required energy and the ability to make decisions quickly. He said these would best be found in one person. Edmund Randolph of Virginia disagreed strongly. He said he considered a one-person executive as the fetus of monarchy. John Dickinson of Delaware said he did not denounce the idea of having a government headed by a king. He said a monarchy was one of the best forms of government in the world. However, in America, he said, a king was out of the question. The debate over the size of the executive leadership lasted a long time. Finally, the delegates voted for a one-person executive. The question of how to limit power was a major part of the delegates' conversation, according to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
We're still talking about what are the limits of the national government? What is the role of the national government? How do we protect individual rights and individual liberties, etc.?
And he says that question continues to be asked in America today. During the debate at the convention, other questions about the national executive arose. One question was the executive's term. Should the executive serve just once, or could that person be re-elected? Alexander Hamilton argued for a long term of office. He said, if a president served only a year or two, America soon would have many former presidents. These former presidents, he said, would fight for power, and that would be bad for the peace of the nation. Benjamin Franklin argued for the right of re-election. The people, he said, were the rulers of a republic, and presidents were the servants of the people. If the people wanted to elect the same president again and again, they had the right to do this. In the final document, the president's term was set at 4 years, with re-election permitted. Next came the question of how to choose the president. It was a most difficult problem. The delegates debated and voted, and then re-debated and re-voted on a number of proposals. James Wilson proposed that the executive be elected by special representatives of the people called electors. Several delegates disagreed. They said the plan would be too difficult to carry out and would cost too much money. One delegate proposed that the president be elected by the state governors. He said the governors of large states would have more votes than the governors of small states. Nobody liked this proposal, especially delegates from the small states. Another proposal was to have the president elected directly by the people. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts was shocked by this idea. "The people do not understand these things," he said. "A few dishonest men can easily fool the people." The worst way to choose a president, he said, would be to have him elected by the people. The convention voted on the issue 60 times. In the end, the delegates agreed that the president should be chosen by electors named by state legislatures. Now someone said, "We have decided how to choose the president, but what are we to do if he does bad things after being chosen? We should have some way of dismissing that person." Yes, the delegates agreed, it should be possible to try the president, and if he is found guilty, remove him from office. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania spoke in support of the right of impeachment should the president be persuaded to betray his trust. The delegates approved a proposal for removing a president found guilty of bribery, treason, or other high crimes. The last major question about executive authority was the question of veto power over the national legislature. Not one delegate was willing to give the president complete power to reject new laws, and yet they felt he should have some voice in the lawmaking process. If this were not done, they said, the office of president would have little meaning, and the national legislature would have the power of a dictator. James Madison offered a solution. "The president should have the power to veto a law," Madison said, "but his veto could be overturned if most of the members of the legislature voted to pass the law again." The final convention document listed more details about the office. For example, it said the president had to be a natural-born citizen of the United States or a citizen at the time the Constitution was adopted. The president must have lived in the United States for at least 14 years and be at least 35 years old. The executive would be paid, but the pay could not be increased or reduced during the term in office. The president would be commander-in-chief of the armed forces and, from time to time, report to the legislature on the State of the Union. The final document also gave the words by which a president would be sworn in. Every 4 years, for more than 200 years now, each president has repeated this oath of office. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Another major issue debated by the convention was a national judiciary, a federal system of courts and judges. The delegates knew a lot about the issue. 34 of them were lawyers. 8 were judges in their home states. One question hung heavy in the air. The states had their own courts and judges. Did the national government need its own system too? Several delegates said no. Roger Sherman of Connecticut said existing state courts were enough. Besides, he said, a system of national courts would be too costly. John Rutledge of South Carolina opposed a national system of lower courts, but he argued for a Supreme Court. Eventually, the convention voted for both. There would be a Supreme Court and a system of lower courts. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the United States. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. The next question concerned the appointment of national judges. Some delegates believed judges should be appointed by the legislature. Others believed they should be appointed by the president. James Wilson argued in support of having one person appoint judges. He said experience showed that large bodies could not make appointments fairly or openly. John Rutledge disagreed strongly. By no means, he said, should the president appoint judges. He said that method looked too much like monarchy. Benjamin Franklin then told a funny little story. In Scotland, he said, he understood that judges were appointed by lawyers. They always chose the very best lawyer to be a judge. Then they divided that person's cases among themselves. The delegates voted on the issue. They agreed that the legislature could decide how many judges would sit on the Supreme Court. The president would appoint the judges. The legislature could establish lower courts from time to time. The president would appoint those judges too. The issues involving the executive and the federal courts were serious questions that most delegates felt strongly about. But the most hotly debated issue of the convention was still to come.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.